All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Moms Fighting Autism. This presentation today is part of our third annual Autism Conference. We're glad you're with us. I'm your moderator, Nancy Bernotitis, and I want to give you a little bit of housekeeping before I introduce our speaker tonight or today. If you wish to view the slides and you're an Internet user, you can go to your blue box and click Slides to view the slideshow. You can synchronize the slides with either your phone or the webcast audio by clicking the button at the bottom of the slideshow. Be sure to mute your computer if you're listening via phone so you don't get an echo. And we are having an issue getting the right presentation with the right link, so bear with us. They're working on it right now. So without further ado, I want to introduce Dennis DeBott. Dennis is the proud father of Brad, a young man who has autism. He's a professional investigator and a law enforcement trainer. Dennis has authored or co-authored over 30 articles and books since 1993, including Autism Advocates and Law Enforcement Professionals, Recognizing and Reducing Risk Situations for People with Autism Spectrum Disorders, articles for the FBI Law Enforcement Bulletin, April 2001, and many other law enforcement and autism publications. Tonight, Dennis will be presenting Preparing for That Autism Emergency. Welcome, Dennis.
Thanks, Nancy. Hi, everybody. I'm glad that I have the chance to be with you over the Internet, over the phone. We'll take a look at a tough issue today, but hopefully have share a laugh. But most importantly, I'm looking for your feedback on today's presentation. And if we can answer any of your questions, we will. If we can't, then we'll find the answer for you. We all know in the autism community, whether we're parents or care providers, family members, people that work with us, we know that people with autism are more like us than not. They are part of the human condition, just as we all are. And as such, we all have three basic needs in our lives that we have to fill. One is we all need to have something to do with our time every day that other people have see value in and reward us with the stuff of life, whether it's money or shelter or clothing or even an attaboy or a pat on the back. So that's one need we all share in common. People with autism want and need to do that too. Secondly, we need to take a break from the work every once in a while and have some fun. Recreation, it can be the arts, it could be music, it could be sports, taking a walk in the park, caring for a pet, reading a book, playing a game, whatever it is, we need to take a break and have some recreation or a little bit of fun. And so do people with autism. They need that every bit as much as we do. And third, we all need to have friends out here. We need to bring joy into the lives of others, whether it's our family, the people we grew up with, our coworkers, our neighbors, our friends. And we need them to do that for us, too. And though that may be difficult for some of our sons and daughters on the spectrum, it doesn't mean they don't want to do that or don't have that basic need. So we're all more alike than not. We all have the same desires in life, and I'm sure you all agree that we all have the same needs and the same hopes and the same dreams. And if you can see the screen, there's a picture of my son Brad with a couple of his dreams. But the objective for today, of course, is to develop a safety plan so we can have an idea of what some of the risks might be out here in the community, have a plan that addresses them in a variety of ways. So that's the goal of today, is to help you and everyone out here share that special knowledge that we all have about that person with autism that you care for, that you work with, that you love. As well as getting that into the hands of others who need to know now. And that population certainly would include the police, law enforcement, fire rescue, the emergency medical services, people that are public safety professionals, including 911 telecommunicators. So it's really a key that we're willing to share this knowledge that we've gathered over the years that we know about that particular person. We're the experts here. So the key goal here today will be strategies to share that information. Now, we all become familiar with these terms, low and high functioning. I don't really like them that much, but we hear those terms used for people on the spectrum. But oftentimes we don't hear those terms applied to people who don't have disabilities. My wife says I'm low functioning in a major part of my life right now that I'm really not going to further describe, but we can all be low or high functioning, but it's the independence level of the child or adolescent or adult with autism that'll give you a hint, an insight, a key into what type of public safety and criminal justice risks just might be out there for your son or daughter or the person that you're working with. Now, one of the key issues out here, it's something that I first identified and reported on back in the early 1990s, is this tendency among our community, some of, in our community, to wander away from safety and into danger without a clue to the consequences. And many of us are touched and by the tragedy of this activity. Now, what I would like you to do, and maybe Nancy, you can let the audience know that we're going to all click on the dangerous wandering video. Before you do, this is a segment from our autism and law enforcement video that we produced a few years back, and it's now used in training rooms throughout North America, in Canada, Australia and New Zealand as an example, as a training tool for law enforcement professionals so they get a sense of what an autism-related call might be. This is the wandering section, so go ahead and click it on, and then on the other side we'll discuss what we just saw.
So in your blue box there's a link that says presentation video link. Click that and it'll take you to the video that he's discussing, and you can click play.
Yeah, that would be. You should be at the top of your list. It's titled Dangerous Wandering.
My video has ended. When your video ends, you can go back to the slides. Dennis, I'm still on plan your response for an autism emergency. I don't know if they're not advancing. I'm sure you're
aware. my slides are advancing, everybody, so I'll do my best to describe what they are.
Thank you.
If you can't see them. But if you can, we're on slide number 8. And what we want to accomplish out here are safe interactions with first responders at home, when we're out in the community, and on the campuses where our sons and daughters go to become, to get educated, and anywhere we may go when we're traveling. But the key and really the theme of today's session will be disclosure. Thinking about the decision to disclose, and what I mean by disclosure is letting people know who work in these professions prior to or even during an emergency, but proactively is the best way to do it. You're going to have to let them know that the child, the adult, the adolescent, the people we love have autism. We cannot expect the police or fire rescue to be able to diagnose autism in the field. Heck, we can't even get pediatricians to diagnose autism correctly. But with disclosure and in training, that will become the key. So that's what we'll review here, the decision to disclose, and some of the ways that you can do it. Now, many of you out here may already have these on your vehicles, in your homes. You may wear T-shirts, have bumper stickers, a variety of what I describe as the icons of autism. These are awareness tools that all contain the word autism. And in training rooms throughout North America and with my colleagues on the West Coast, East Coast, and all around the world, we are making it very clear in the training rooms that this is how you will make the discovery. It may come through your experience. You may see something different, but it'll be much more likely that autism will be mentioned in the 911 call. A neighbor will come out and say, well, that's the neighbor kid. He has autism. Or that the police or other first responders will view these icons of autism. So what I'd like you to do now is, and I'll narrate through this, your second video, autism icons. So I'll give everybody a second or two, you can follow Nancy's instructions, and we'll get on to that clip.
It's attached to the same link, the presentation video link, and it's just beneath the Dangerous Wandering video, Autism Icons.
Okay, here. So it says Autism Awareness. You either have viewed or are viewing a vehicle that has an example, and there are other examples other than this one. We'll see others, but this one's pretty profound. Emergency alert: occupant with autism may not respond to verbal command. Anyone reading that in an emergency has just read a story about who may be inside that car. But magnet puzzle ribbon. Autism awareness magnet is, I've seen them everywhere I go. The I love someone with autism a bumper sticker. These are all disclosures, especially in an emergency where your police and other first response professionals have been trained. On-scene autism form, emergency contact form, we will review shortly, as well as there are cards that our organization has available for law enforcement to carry and people with autism and their care providers that provide some generalized tips for interacting with a person with autism. I'm going to, if we're back at the slideshow, I'm moving on to slide 12, and slide 13. And that would be an example of an autism awareness license plate. These license plates, and I'll move through to, so you can see other ones from different parts of the U.S. These license plates now become disclosure tools. So if you're living in a state that provides the specialty license plate, or if you're in a country that may be considering them, I would strongly urge you get involved in those efforts, acquire the plate, put it on your vehicles, because it then in and of itself becomes an alert that this may be an autism-related contact. Including in Louisiana, they have one in the form of the fleur-de-lis. You can be as creative as you need to be. And it does not have to be one symbol or one particular icon, but it should contain the word autism. I believe that's the key. And in North America, we are now seeing autism traffic signs that can also be useful for neighborhoods. These are all your choices to make. Nobody will force you to do anything like this, but again, they all can make the sudden contact, the emergency contact, go smoother when awareness is attached to it.
Dennis,
so
is there a I'm sorry. I was just going to ask if there was a recommended place on your car that you would put a cling?
Yeah, I would. Your bumpers are free. The trunk area are always places you could put a cling or a bumper sticker. You would want to check with the laws in your state or your province or your country about placing stickers actually on the window. Some parts in the world are fine with it, and other places they may give you a ticket because you're blocking your rear view. So check with local ordinance, but you're certainly free to put it on your bumpers, on the trunk, on the side of your car. Consider other icons, T-shirts, pins. Make sure you have handouts available in your vehicles and at home, and if it's a younger child, in their backpack, so it could be discovered. And we will review another video clip that clearly illustrates how useful and important that may be.
Thank you.
But for the contact with law enforcement that's public safety related, we should be prepared for it and then be alerted to it and then respond in the best and most responsible way we can. And this certainly pertains to wandering. Of course it does. We would also want to consider contacting our neighbors. You do not necessarily need to do an autism workshop on the porch of your neighbor, but it would be easy enough to bring a photograph of your child or children, let them see that, let them know how to contact you, your phone numbers. So if they see your son or daughter out, they may be the first persons to notice this, even before you do. So they would have an opportunity to call you. And if they saw the need to call emergency phone numbers, 911 in North America, I wouldn't ask anybody to do anything that they didn't think was right. But you need the alert, too. And, of course, if there are people in their home that you could take a look out for, or even their pet, that's okay, too. You don't need to go too much further than the neighbors that you can see from your property. So you don't need to go five blocks away because they're not going to likely know where you live or anything else. But the people that you can see from the back of your house, the front of your house, yeah, it's reasonable and a good idea to do that, alerting your neighbors. Okay, we're at slide 20. Let's meet Jeffrey. Jeffrey has an interesting story. This video clip came from the first autism awareness video for law enforcement back in 1998. But I think Jeffrey's story is an interesting one, and he sure is a fun guy. So go to your videos. It would be the one that says Old ALE Jeffrey. It's the third one from the top.
Okay. My video has ended.
Okay, everybody. Hopefully you had a chance to meet Jeffrey. I loved his negotiation tactics with Mom. Very enlightening, huh?
Mm-hmm.
So now we're at slide 21, and it's what to disclose. There is a lot of information to disclose, including what that person's, your son or daughter's name is. You would want to consider a digital photograph that is recent, a description, how tall, how much they weigh, eye color, hair color. But a key for the first responder will be to know how they communicate, if they're verbal, if they are nonverbal, if they use picture exchange communication systems or computers that speak for them, or sign language of any sort, if they display any physical characteristics. But even more importantly would be sensory issues, if they may have them, the lights, the sounds, the odors, the touches, the tastes, the odors. If these affect your behavior at all, that should be in your form. what that person likes, what they dislike. These will all be keys to success for you. And slide 22 has an example of some of the information you could put into your emergency contact form. You have a more, you can get a more complete and detailed example of that up at our website, Autism Risk Safety Management. Or, I'm sorry, AutismRiskManagement.com. And you also have a handout that you can read and review after today's session. I also wanted you to just take a quick look, and for all of us who use cell phones, that you would want to create an in case of emergency contact in your call list on your cell phone. So if you got hurt or you were in an accident and somebody picked up your phone from first response, they're trained to look at your phone, look at the contact list, and if it says ICE in there, those would be the numbers they would call first. So you could have ICE1, ICE2, ICE3, and these would be individuals that would also have this information and could relay it over the phone just in case something happened to you. So at this point, let's go back to our videos and click on the short video, and this one's very brief, and it says ICE. And it's as simple as that. It could be a doctor, it could be your spouse, it could be a relative or people that you've identified as willing and able to take a call during an emergency. So let's move on now to slide 24, if you can. And I did mention it. You want to disclose any and all sensory issues, whatever they may be. We all know that some of our sons and daughters are either hyper or hyposensitive to certain stimulus. And in the case of emergency, it could be sirens, flashing lights, two-way radios or Nextel communication devices that suddenly go on and loudly. There could be the presence of a canine partner or dogs or mounted patrol horses. There can be a lot of confusion and noise. An accident or other scenes that could set behavior off could include the odors of an accident, smoke, or even for some people with autism, they may close into shiny objects, be attracted to certain things, or they need more of the sensation. That's the kind of information that a first responder, police, emergency medical, fire, can use to make their call more professional, more informed, and safe for all involved. So we would want to consider having that information on your form, as well as behavioral de-escalation, or what we know as meltdowns. If someone and they can simply be set off in some cases by sensory issues, but it could be for a variety of reasons that we're aware of, or that we might be able to predict, and of course there may be reasons that we don't know yet why someone may have an aggressive escalation of behavior. But the tips that you could offer in that form to help someone calm down a person with autism, to give them enough time and space and non-confusing language and body language. These are also being taught in our training rooms everywhere. But how they apply to a particular person is, of course, going to be another key to success out there during an emergency. Slide 27. ID, info cards, T-shirts, tattoos. What the heck am I talking about? If your child, adolescent, or adult cannot tell people their name, address, or phone number, they need really to carry something with them that does. And in some cases, it could be simply state-issued ID or an ID card that you make up with basic information about who to call. It could be, carried in a backpack. It could be laminated and worn through a belt, so you could see it prominently on the side of a garment, or it could be you could sew in a place with Velcro. You could slide the ID card in. It could be hanging from a tag. Medic alert jewelry. It can be considered for use. Shoe tags that have name, address, phone number. Or they now have shoelaces where you can actually have that information printed right into the shoelace. But not everybody will wear these objects. So for those that won't, you might want to consider silk screening or imprinting that information on an undergarment, or even consider the use of temporary or non-permanent ID tattoos. So these are a variety of options that you could take. But once again, law enforcement is being educated to look for these items out there. At this point, I want to show again another video clip. This one comes from Autism Fire Rescue and Emergency Medical Services that we produced a few years back. And this illustrates the value of disclosure and how that might work. If you are out in the community away from home and your emergency happened to you as opposed to your children, so please go back to your video list and click on the fire rescue clip. Okay, are you finished, Nancy?
A couple more, about 45 seconds. It's just hard to watch. Okay, my video is finished.
Okay. We'll be at slide 29. But before I talk about that, you just saw a video where, although it was hard to watch, we understand that. It also is enlightening because Mom took the very proactive disclosure options that we're discussing. She made sure there was a form in the glove box. She put the decal on the back of the car. The Good Samaritan who came upon the accident noticed it, made it part of the 911 call, and the responders knew what to expect, what to look for when they got there, because of their training. Now, these are training videos for law enforcement and fire rescue, but they're also valuable tools for us to get a glimpse into the very dangerous, serious nature of their jobs in an emergency and how we can help them out. That's really what we're here for to talk with you today about. Tracking technology. I know it's popular out here. There are some terrific programs that law enforcement manage through the use of radio frequency tracking technology, and that's quite simply is a transmitter on the child or adult who may wander away that is always transmitting a signal, and in case they wander away dangerously, law enforcement can respond 24/7 and be able to home in on the signal that's being.
Uh-oh, we've lost audio. Are you still there, Dennis? Okay, well, Dennis calls back in. I will sing a musical. No, I won't torture you with that, but I'll tell a little story about my own son wandering away. We just moved into our new house, and I was moving boxes in and out, and he was about four or five years old, and he was there, he was there, he was there, he was not there. And so I was looking throughout the house for him, and he happened to be standing out in the driveway with some strangers I did not know, and I ran out, and I scooped him up, and discovered that he had wandered all the way down the street and he was in the middle of the road stopping traffic. And he had led them back to our home, but after that, we had discovered we had a security system attached to the house, so we started just playing with it to try and get it just to alert me when the door was opened. And little did I know, it was being monitored by the police department and the fire department. And the next thing I know, here comes all the apparatus down the street. Every piece of equipment the city owned was on its way to my house. And a little bit miffed that there was no real emergency. But after explaining that my son had wandered away, we were able to calm the first responders down, and I was actually able to start the Take Me Home program here at in our town with the police department and the fire department. And it's something that was started in Pensacola, Florida, where my brother lives, and he told me about it, and I got it started here in our city. And it's explained in the handout. If you're able to get the handout that's attached here, there's a link. It does explain the Take Me Home program. So,
hey, Nancy, can you hear me?
Yeah, you're back.
I don't know what happened, everybody. I didn't touch anything, but I am back. And thanks for covering that. The registry programs are terrific. Take Me Home is now branching out throughout the U.S. Canada has started a terrific series of registry programs. I would like you to go to slide 30. And I'll give you a little background on that. Take Me Home, the Ottawa Police Service Autism Registry, have a lot in common. They are able to take your information and use it not only if you need to call 911 or if 911 is called about your home, but they in North America and increasingly around the world, all patrol vehicles have onboard computers, where this information can be in the onboard computer and can be observed without having to broadcast it over the 911 system. Ottawa took it one step further in their program by creating that unique decal you see on the slide that allows you, if you register, to put in your registry number, and they will give you as many decals as you might need. You can put those on your vehicle, and the police service in Ottawa, Canada, is trained to recognize that and then get the registry number and go into their database, when it's safe to do so, of course, and get key information that can improve the call. So it takes it out of the home and out of the hands of the 911 system, and just like the video clip we saw, that decal or that icon becomes even more informative. So, again, wherever you live, work with your advocacy agencies, other communities that may have the same needs, Alzheimer's, dementia, people with traumatic brain injury, fetal alcohol syndrome, intellectual disability. The more people that are asking for the service, the more likely you're going to get it. So we want to create a handout. Adapt and amend it to suit your needs. No one is going to force you to put anything in there that you don't want in there. Develop a plan about how to use it. Talk to people that you trust, other family members, neighbors, friends. Think about some of the scenarios that you just saw and work out what you will do in case of an emergency. The information is best used when it's proactive. Because in the heat of the moment, if someone's having a behavioral meltdown or they're aggressive and police are on scene and now you're telling them, well, don't touch them, you're trying to direct what they do, it's probably not going to work. Because at that point, how do they know that you're telling them the truth? They can't know that. And they have certain protocols and safety protocols they have to follow. So it's best served proactively. Role play it with friends, talk about what you do, role play it a little bit. What would happen if we had a fire? What would happen if our son or daughter bolted away and we discovered it? Let's role play it so you can become familiar and make it work for you. I mean, that's always going to be the key, making it work for you. And absolutely, I know it says on here, keep records. Yes, keep records of everything you're doing. Keep a log. About your plan, what you've done, how you've planned it out, because you never know. in the aftermath of an incident. Someone may question how you manage this whole event. If you're keeping records about everything that you've done to plan for it, that just goes to prove that you were certainly aware of the issue and that you were quite willing and you had planned ahead. What about risk and safety issues at the IEP? I would strongly recommend it. If you have a safety plan in place for the home and community, it should also be implemented on campuses where our sons and daughters may spend a lot of their time as children. So that plan that you've developed, if it's fair and reasonable, can be implemented when you're not there. So a good time to address a lot of these issues would be right at the IEP. Partnerships with the first response law enforcement community, with educators, parents, family members, absolutely. Create opportunities where our sons and daughters can meet police, fire, rescue, get inside of an ambulance, see what the sights and sounds are, put on the fire rescue gear so that it's less frightening, take a tour of the police car so they can meet people who provide safety in an environment that is safe for all concerned. And I would also suggest that if students and responders can meet in the classroom, that would be a good idea too. So these partnerships are sprouting up all over North America. These are good proactive plans that will increase safety, lower risk, and get both communities educated about each other's needs. For our sons and daughters, they're going to need training and life skills, education from a very early age throughout their life, really. We all need it. Frequent bursts of information given over a long period of time, short, frequent bursts is an educational tool that's really well suited to this subject. Community days at a fire station where police cars could come out, our families could visit. Again, these have proven to be successful in other communities around North America, and I'd be happy to provide more information on that. But the more we can be proactive, the better off in the long run we're going to be. And getting that first response education in the classroom, absolutely critical. Okay, what's next, you say? Next is dispel the myths, the rumors, and the preconceptions about autism in general and about our individual sons and daughters. The information we provide in the training rooms can only be generic. We can only talk about a group, and that it these things may or may not work. You can make it person specific when you get involved in handouts, when you proactively disclose. They're going to know exactly how your son or daughter operates out here, which even upgrades it to another level outside the training room. Open up discussions, attend and reach out to the police, the fire, the emergency medical professionals in your communities, and talk about it. They may have some misconceptions, or if they don't live with autism, we can't expect them to understand it. But with the rate that it is at these days, you will find more and more people in those public safety services that have a direct connection to autism. Meet those people, open up the discussions. I couldn't leave here today without having you get sent off on your Saturday, or if you're in the Pacific, it might be Sunday now, I don't know. But let's go back to the video clips and hear from people with autism, hear it from the voices of autism. So click on that video and we'll wrap it up on the other end. Yeah, it's pretty profound. Let's do it for autism. I don't think I could say it any better. We're best served when we're proactive, but it's always good to plan ahead whenever you can. But there's nothing wrong with making sure that information could be found during an emergency. It's never too late. There are families that couldn't be here today, and I think that's one of the reasons we all are here, is because it's difficult to get to a conference. Our son will be 29 here shortly. Over the years, people got to know either myself or my wife because we could never go to a conference together. We know how tough it is. We live it, these lives right along with you. Develop a response plan. I hope this inspires everybody to do it. I'm not going anywhere. We'll stay here as long as need be for any questions you might have. But I want to thank everybody. I'm thrilled, honored, and privileged to spend a little bit of time with you. And stay safe.
Well, we're thrilled, honored, and privileged to have you here.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
I have a question for you before I start asking other people's questions. It's one of the perks of being the moderator. You were talking about putting an ICE in case of emergency number into your phone.
Yes.
Would you recommend that people do not password protect their phones then, so emergency responders could access it?
Well, if yes, I don't know what the password protection would be for. I'm sure there are a ton of good reasons. But these days, with the price of technology coming down, 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 you know, you could carry two phones. You could carry one that has no protection on it that is just used in an emergency. But there are a million good reasons why you would want to pass protect your phone. But, Nancy, you just came up with one real good reason why you wouldn't.
A very good one. Okay, so Carol from, I assume this is Philadelphia, says Phila. My son is 16 and starting to venture out on his own. He has Asperger's. He's a bit quirky, but he has learned a lot of self-control in the past few years. He tends to not try to interact with people on the street. We're trying to encourage his independence. What kind of advice should we give him if he encounters police so as to keep things appropriate?
Yeah, that's a good question, Carol. I've written a couple of book chapters in books for typically younger people with Asperger's that go right to that. How to do it. Disclosing to Authorities was the title of one, and Safety in the Community was the title of the other. We have some good information there. They're both from you can find them at jkp.com. One title is Asperger's Syndrome in Adolescence. The other is Coming Out Asperger, and it's a book about disclosure. But what you will read in there, and I think the key is, hopefully your son would be willing and able to disclose that he has a condition to law enforcement, as well as develop a person-specific card, and there are examples in those book chapters, that he could carry with him, even if he became so far under stress that he couldn't communicate. And I know people on the spectrum where under these circumstances, that even those who communicate well won't be able to, that if he carried something with him that could tell his story, that would be a good idea.
And that falls under the same question that Lisa from Oregon asked. Dennis, my 23-year-old son, is verbal. When he gets stressed, he stammers, and it takes longer to get out his thoughts. And I've wondered if there's some kind of wallet card that he could hand to a police officer if he were in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah, we saw that in the clips, the icons of autism. And if you go to our website, debotlegacy.com, you'll have to spell my name right, but it's or email me, ddpi@flash.net. The generic cards could be something that your son could carry. My son does. He carries, he's verbal, but, you know, under stress, yeah, right. Everybody in those situations is under stress, even the first responder or the police officer. Their training is what gets them through that. So maybe working with our young people who are more independent, to role play, get a chance to meet the police, talk to them about what he should do. We have a new video out shortly, which is Autism and the Decision to Drive. And we have a segment in there about what to do when the police pull you over if you're a driver. And so these are good tools for young people on the spectrum to learn or to look at over and over and get a sense about what they can do when the police are suddenly on the scene with them. Because you'll have no warning typically.
No name attached to this one, but the question is there any kind of national training program that police and emergency responders can acquire?
And what do you know what nation that is?
I
can answer this.
Florida.
There is no national training program. I'll just talk about the U.S. In the U.S., we're made up of 50 states, all with their own different nuance of how they conduct training and why and what's required. So passing a national law to require it in the U.S. would be difficult. In other countries, it could be accomplished. I could see that happening in more centralized governments. But our training group, we've visited almost every state in America, most of the provinces of Canada. I provided training in Iceland, in the UK, and I'm planning a trip over to New Zealand later on this year. So we have, and our program's been certified for credits in well over 20 states, but it's not a national program where everybody's required to get it. But you never know the way things are going.
Okay, someone from Cincinnati, Ohio has a question. I'm protecting her identity just in case she wants me to. She has a 3-year-old with autism, and she asks why it's hard to get a small community to protect and understand individuals with ASD. She's been under constant supervision for the past 5 years from Child Protection Services.
And her child is 3?
3.
And who's been under supervision for 5 years? Who wrote in?
Yes.
So she was under supervision before.
Oh, wait. Not a 3-year-old. She has 3 with autism.
Oh,
sorry about that.
Okay. Each one of our family stories is so similar to many of us out here. But on the other hand, they're all unique and individual. So it's so difficult to make a comment on that other than to say that we need better training for social service professionals, and I can guarantee you they are at many of the trainings we offer. But if there are people that we're interacting with who don't know what our lives are like, it's difficult for them to make decisions. I can see how people could make and come to the wrong conclusions when they are working with a family affected by autism or an individual child or adult. It's one of the reasons I've been doing this work for 21 years. I get that. So, in order to answer an individual question, because they'll all have different circumstances, it's just too hard to make a comment on, a broad-based comment. But we're working at it. Let's just look back 15, 16 years ago. None of this information was available. There were no videos. No one had written about it. So at least we've put a serious dent into the issue.
What do you think about the anti-wandering GPS devices?
GPS, it's going to depend on the quality of the GPS, who is offering it. I've seen a huge increase in the providers of this service. And I did write in my book a comparison of radio frequency tracking, which is what law enforcement is using, which is, in my opinion, a much better a signal and technical service. GPS can be wonderful, but it could, be blocked in certain terrain or inside buildings. It's not going to be very useful in the aftermath of an event that knocks power out. And, you know, do your homework if you're going to purchase a GPS system. Just make sure you know how well it works and who's providing it, their background. And, you know, a slick website does not mean that the device is really going to work real well. So I think there's a real future for GPS out here. But it really is dependent oftentimes on the families to monitor. And I think in these situations, I'd much prefer to have professionals handling the search and rescue because you're under enough stress if your child goes missing.
And I'm not sure how many people are aware that there are service dogs that can track an individual with autism. We have one for my son.
Not all service dogs are trackers, but
right.
If they're saying it's a tracker, it's a tracker. If your family can consider its use, if the person with autism, child or an adult, likes animals. Some people don't like animals.
Mm-hmm.
Some people do. But that's certainly an option. It's a good one, and one that's people should explore.
Yeah, I advocate for that myself. The organization we used was Four Paws for Ability in Xenia, Ohio, and our tracking dog, immediately goes into work mode and finds him, and much faster than emergency response could even get to the scene.
Right. Every part of your plan, your safety plan, should include all of these options.
Mm-hmm.
If I had my druthers, I'd have a GPS and a radio frequency transmitter. I would have the tracking dog. I would have the 911 registry program. I would alert my neighbors. I would have invisible fence. Or I would call up my burglar alarm company and have something that if the door or window opened up, I'm going to wake up because I do know that the alert is the key part of search and rescue. You can prepare all you want, but if you're not alerted to it, you can't respond.
And that is the downside of the dog, for instance. You have to realize that the child is missing before you can alert
right.
the dog. If I don't know
right.
that Sam's missing, he's got his ID bracelet on, the town has been alerted that, you know, who he is and that he wanders.
Yes.
The neighbors all know him. So, you know, you've got to build in a multi-tiered safety net.
As much of this that you can do, not everybody can afford all of this stuff. You know, I get that too. But disclosure, I know, is going to be the key for not only help in search and rescue so they don't have to gather information in the first 15 minutes from you when you've already provided much of it beforehand, but it can also help in these situations where the person's more independent or that they get away from home or have, the accident or a sudden interaction with law enforcement at campus or the meltdown occurs when you're not there. We need to be more proactive with getting information into the hands of these first responders. Yes, the tracking devices are terrific. Hopefully we never have to use them, but the rate of contact is not all about wandering. There are many other ways that people with autism can come into contact with law enforcement where they don't know they have autism.
Mm-hmm.
And those are very high-risk contacts, and they're not all due to wandering.
Carmen from Vancouver asks, where can I get something to put in my car and on the window about ASD? Where can she...
You mean a decal that we...
Yeah.
There are, I think, buttonsandmore.com. I believe that's the address. He has a terrific display of awareness icons, autism awareness icons. There are many organizations that are creating decals. The you know, our national autism advocacy groups, Autism Canada, Autism Ontario. Again, the key here is going to be the word autism. So there are a variety of the decals or magnets that you could use. I say use a few of them. But as long as they're easy to read, then I think that's the key. And if our friends in Vancouver want any further information, please give me an email, ddpi@flash.net.
Yeah, we have them on our household doors and windows and on our car and everywhere. Can you tell me, I mean, since you do the training for the first responders, is it becoming more and more accepted or understood by law enforcement? Do most, you know, systems have some training in place?
Well, it's still a work in progress, but to answer your question directly, yes, the law enforcement community in general, not only in the U.S. but elsewhere around the world, is much more interested in this, in safe interactions with people with autism than they used to be. Just a very brief history lesson. I'll repeat it real quick. I started looking at this in 1991, reported in 1993, first report. And at that time, before then, there was nothing out here about autism. And that's what caused me as an investigator and a journalist to look into this in the first place, and as a dad of a younger child then. He was only 8 or 9. But over the years, the doors in training rooms opened up to me, and we built credibility over the years. I think one of the key articles was for the FBI Law Enforcement Bulletin that was published in April 2001. That really sent it out to a global law enforcement community. And the FBI is, of course, an extremely globally credible organization, and their publication, that bulletin, is a training manual for a lot of smaller departments around the world. So we were able to get it on the map there. Over the years, I've been invited into Department of Homeland Security training rooms. I've worked with NYPD, Chicago PD, Seattle PD is using our video to train everyone there. Portland, Oregon has their police bureau has been trained, everyone. The state of Texas granted our group a contract to provide training throughout Texas. There are maybe a half a dozen states that make it mandatory. And so when we think that maybe only 16, 17 years ago it didn't exist, and now we've and there's a terrific program up in Boston, the Autism and Law Enforcement Training Coalition. They alone have trained over 20,000 professionals in New England and elsewhere. A group that I work with here in Florida has successfully trained over 5,000 over the past few years. So it's growing, no question. But we have a lot more work to do. We have credibility in the community, and it's less likely for me to hear, well, why do we need to know this, than it used to be. But our families can really do a lot of good by encouraging this type of training in their local communities.
Okay. Those who are calling or listening in on their phones can raise their hand to ask a live question if they'd like by pressing *2, and that'll alert me that you have a question. I have a question about when a first responder is sent to a home, domestic dispute, the child is out of control. Is it handled differently if you know that the individual has a disability or autism than it is if they are just a typical teen lashing out?
Yeah, potentially. These are high-risk contacts. Forget about the autism. Some type of family or domestic dispute or someone is out of control in a home are extremely high risk for people that need to respond. The more information they know before they get there, we can help them respond better. And I'll give you, I'll go back to the Ottawa Police Registry to give you an example of how that worked in that situation. The Globe and Mail, Toronto Globe and Mail reported just this year that the on the registry in Ottawa, saying that they took it from a pilot program when it was launched in April of 2010. It was a pilot. I had trained there about 9 months prior to that. They liked what they heard. They formed their own program, put it out as a pilot. And then in the fall of 2011, they found it to be so useful, they made it a permanent program. And they reported now some success stories. And here's one. Young man, maybe 16 or 17, got a hold of a knife in the family home, was threatening to use it on mom, who called 911, but they were in the registry. So the closest by law enforcers were able to read from their onboard computer something about this young man that they were going to now have to interact with. And in the information that the family shared, it included the fact that this young man just loved hockey, ice hockey, and he loved a particular team and certain players on this particular team. So when they knocked on the door, they didn't say, hey, put the knife down, or the first things out of the responders' mouths were, hey, how about those Ottawa Senators, and how about these particular players? And when the young fellow heard that, he immediately felt comforted by it. And when they say, hey, you need to put the knife down, come on with us, but, you know, let's talk more about how many goals this guy scored or whatever, he complied completely. And that is how information could be used in a situation like that. Are they all going to work out great? No. And even if law enforcement knows someone has autism prior to coming there, there still remains that high risk. And again, under those circumstances where someone has now been reported as a threat to others or themselves, or that they may have a, you know, cutting instrument or another weapon of any sort, there are certain things we can ask the police to do, but they have to make sure they don't get hurt, that others don't get hurt, and in close, close quarters or within a home that they're not familiar with, there are so many things that could happen and quickly. But again, providing that information is just always a good idea.
Yeah, I've been afraid to call because I was afraid that they would take him away, you know, remove him from the home, lock him up.
Yeah.
And I didn't want that scenario.
Well, I understand that, but, you know, for everyone listening here, don't be afraid to seek help here. What we don't want is, for the reasons you just said, Nancy, for something to happen such as the event up there in Kent, Ohio, right?
Right.
Where the young mom felt the same way as you did, wouldn't seek help, took regular beatings from her son, and then ultimately he beat her to death one day.
Mm-hmm.
Only because she was afraid that as a result of calling for help, their son would be taken from the home. I know it's a difficult decision, but I have friends and colleagues who work on these issues who have had to sit around their dinner table with their family and talk about whether or not their own home was the appropriate place to provide the kind of security and safety that their son or daughter needed. It's not an easy question, but again, as I said in the slideshow, if we have to open up discussions on difficult subject matter, such as what you just brought up,
mm-hmm.
we have to be prepared to do that. No one should, accept becoming injured as part of providing appropriate care.
Right.
And but again, these are individual decisions that are not easy to make, but we certainly don't make them any easier by not talking about it, and I'm glad you brought it up.
Mm-hmm. What can we integrate into the curriculum that the individual is learning to help him better respond to first responders or behave appropriately in public, or what kind of things would you suggest?
For the care provider?
No, for the individual with the disability.
Well, it's going to be how able are they to learn these lessons, and some of our within autism, you really have two or three populations when we're looking at safety and risk issues. You have a population that's made up of children and adults who need the care of others at all times during their life, and maybe for their lifetime. So they wouldn't be able to provide their own shelter, food, safety, and security, or be able to communicate very well. So teaching people in that part of our community is going to be vastly different than it would be for the more independent person who is verbal, who may learn to safely use public transportation or learn how to drive, and they certainly in most cases will be able to communicate. How we teach those populations is something that, again, these are good issues to bring up at an IEP. They're every bit as important as learning the academic skills that we all need for our lifetimes. Those are great, but if you don't have the life skills, crossing the street as an example, all the academic skills are going to be fairly useless for you. So I think that when we work with professional educators about what needs to be learned, that we can get some professional advice about how to teach those lessons. I've addressed some of this in a very basic way in my book and in other articles I've written. But it has to be individualized to a particular person. So I think we have a good handle on what needs to be taught, or we can have input there, but how it needs to be taught, if we're not professional educators, we need to have that partnership with them so we can come up with a good curriculum that is creative enough to address this huge wide spectrum that we care about.
Mm-hmm. And when my two typical kids were little, it was no question that we would have a fire exit plan and a safe meeting spot, and we would practice drills. But with my special needs child, that has not even been on the radar. I know it's important, but
yeah,
we haven't even begun to implement, a fire drill.
Yeah,
Would he understand what was going on? Would he realize that it was just a drill? That kind of thing.
As I said in one of the slides, and I know it's a concept of special education, short, frequent bursts of information over a long period of time is a learning style that may suit many people on the spectrum. So having a plan in place for what to do, this is the door we go out, here's the neighbor's lawn that we go to, whatever the plan is, it may have to be shortened up, delivered more frequently. It might get real boring for your other two kids, but the shorter it is, the more simple it is, and the more frequently you go over it, could be a key to success there.
Mm-hmm. We live on a second story, and we have one of those ladders, a fire escape ladder.
Okay.
We've never practiced with it, of course, because we live on the second story.
Because he might use it when there isn't a fire.
Yes. But I'm also thinking, in the event of an emergency, how am I going to explain to him that you need to get on this ladder and climb down? We're just going to have to push him out the window because there's no other way.
Everybody, there will be challenges in every one of these structures. That, you know, these are barriers, or you know, they compromise safety. And in your case, you know, that clearly is an issue. If I were in your boat, I think I might want to contact my fire rescue agency and ask them to come out and give us some tips, give us some ideas, work with us. That ALEC program is directed by a colleague and friend who is a fire captain, and they are working on curriculum for students on fire safety issues. Every problem, even if we can't come up with a great answer, we can come up with creative ideas that might work. And when we manage risk, we can't manage it from the standpoint of I'm going to prevent this 100%, because that, you know, it's a nice goal, but you know, the reality is nothing's 100%. So you look at the worst issue or the worst risk that you have in front of you, address the worst thing that could happen first, and work backwards from there. And keep in mind that even if we take every precaution we reviewed today, and things that we haven't reviewed, that even in spite of that, something can happen. I mean, that's the unpredictability of human life. We can't predict what's going to happen next, but we can certainly plan for it.
Mm-hmm.
I always use... Yeah, I use this analogy. Here's risk management for the, I'm sure everybody listening in has heard this aspect of it. Anybody who's been in a car recently or driven one has probably put on their seatbelt, among all of us here. Not a, very few of us, if any of us, got into an accident that day. So was it a waste of time to take the time to put on the seatbelt? After all, you didn't get into an accident. So that's a ridiculous proposition. In most places, it's the law. But where really the law requires us to manage a risk that might never happen. So for the case of autism, the risks are different, but we're still looking into things that maybe haven't happened, maybe never will happen. But we forget about that. We are taking that precaution in case of an emergency, not because of it. It's in case this happens, we're better prepared. So that's what these plans, you know, developing a safety plan and disclosure and tracking technology and education in the classrooms, having a safety plan at home, sharing it with others. You know, that's the whole point. Getting training to the first response community, to the 911 call takers and dispatchers, to fire, to emergency medical, to search and rescue teams, to the hospital ER and beyond, all fits into that plan. And the partners in those services, that's what they do. That's what their training is for. They're constantly training. After our tragedies here in 2001, you know, 9/11, as well as weather events that happen around the world, we don't know when they're going to happen next, but we certainly try to be better prepared. And when we live through them, whatever they may be, and we've lived through them down here with hurricanes, you learn from it, and then you make adjustments to your plan. So I hope this was helpful to everybody out here. Were there any more questions, Nancy?
No, but if somebody has a question they would like to ask you, where would they email you?
Yeah, that's ddpi@flash.net, or they can simply go to the website.